Welcome back to Who's There. I'm your host, Allison. If you're new here, thank you for joining us. This is a podcast where I talk to a new horror fan every week because I hope to destigmatize what it means to be a horror movie fan, because most of us are just regular people who like the adrenaline rush of being scared for some reason, and here we delve into those reasons. This week, I had the opportunity to chat with Brian Brulegg, who is the creator of the blog and the podcast, The Sociologist Dojo. He is a college professor, and this is a blog and a podcast that focuses on the social analysis of film and popular culture by using sociological perspective, and oftentimes he focuses on horror movies. We talked about why he loves the movie Mandy so much, why he thinks social commentary in horror is stronger and more persistent than in other genres, and why he's still a sucker for a good jump scare even when he knows that it's coming. One last thing before we get into this episode, if you love the show and haven't left us a review on iTunes yet, I'd be so grateful if you could take a second to rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and subscribe to our feed wherever you listen to us. Thank you to everyone who's already left us a review. It's so appreciated, as it really helps people to find us. I think I've rambled enough, so let's get into my conversation with Brian Brulegg. Hey, Brian, how are you?
I am doing fine. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. I'm glad we finally found time, because I know we've gone back and forth a bit. So do you want to start by telling everyone a little bit about yourself, where you're from, et cetera?
Sure. I am an assistant professor of sociology at Rio Hondo College in Whittier, California. And I am the creator and host of the Sociologist Dojo, a blog and podcast that is analyzing film and popular culture using the sociological perspective.
That sounds super interesting. I wish I lived in California so I could take your class, but we will get into that in a little bit.
Absolutely.
First things first, what's your favorite scary movie?
Oh, hands down, no question. It is 2018's Mandy by Panos Cosmatos. It is a phantasmagoric masterpiece.
I watched it back in October for the first time. It is definitely interesting. Mel Gibson is, Nick Cage, Jesus Christ, is great in it. I had tried watching it once before. The plot that I remembered from the half that I watched that time was not the same plot that I remember when I watched it this time. Was I on mushrooms as well? Was I on psychedelics? I don't know.
Well, the first half and the second half are not completely different, but they have different tones, because the first half is Mandy's film, played by Andrea Riseborough, and the second half is just Nick Cage just doing cocaine and, you know, LSD and just killing demon bikers.
Yeah. So why is that one your favorite? What is it about it that speaks to you?
First, the cinematic or the cinematography is phenomenal. The color scheme in that film, the way that it plays with color and how it connects to emotion, so very calm and serene moments are filled with like blues and grays and golds. And anytime that there is any kind of danger, you just get flooded with this color of red and darkness and strobe lighting and all of this other sort of stuff. So visually, it is a feast for anyone who's interested in any kind of cinematography whatsoever. It also is a very quiet film and has a lot to do with thematics around the patriarchy, issues of feminism and masculinity. Like each character, and I write about this on the blog, each character sort of represents different aspects of the patriarchy and different aspects of either masculinity or femininity, or femininity's response to masculinity itself. And then there's Nick Cage, who does a whirlwind performance that goes from very, very quiet and sort of stoic to rage, coke-filled, you know, insanity by the end. And it's unfortunate that, like, he gets this sort of bad rap of just being Nick Cage in sort of Nick Cage films, But there is this one scene in Mandy, it's the bathroom scene. And if anyone has ever seen the movie, you know exactly what scene I'm talking about, where he goes 0 to 1,000 in like 15 seconds and then back down again. And you don't tend to appreciate the sheer gravity of the grief that he's going through. And most people will look at that film or look at that moment and just say, well, it's just Nick Cage being Nick Cage. But this is the first film that I think gets Nick Cage, and like Nick Cage is best suited for that film. Like the film, because usually Nick Cage sort of acts over the material that he's in. This is one film where Nick Cage has to elevate himself to meet the film's actual position.
Oh, that's really interesting. And I love when people talk about color palettes that are used in horror movies, because I never noticed them. So I always find it so interesting when other people can read more deeply into horror movies like that. I love
it's beautiful.
So how did you first fall in love with the horror genre?
It was a slow burn, really, because generally, especially when I was a kid, I was like a very fearful person. So like my first, dipping my toes in the horror waters, so to speak, it really like shook me, right? Because I remember like the film Ghoulies was on like television like one time. And I watched this like heart-ripping scene when I was like, I don't know, 6, and it flipped me out. And I literally like ran away from horror, right? So like Nightmare on Elms, like, cause I grew up in the 80s. And so it was like wall to wall slasher films. So like Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th and, you know, Halloween and all that sort of stuff. And I just sort of, I didn't understand it. And I didn't like the anxiety that it would bring in me. And it wasn't, there was a couple times where I watched certain amalgam films, you know, like it was horror, but it was a comedy, or it was horror, but it was more a thriller, or it was a crime film, but it wasn't, you know, it was this sort of combination. And so it wasn't until really like, you know, after I was an adult and I started to really think about like, you know, film as an art form and really embracing that love, did I start to sort of chip away at that fear and be like, okay, I'm going to sit, I'm going to watch it, I'm going to be entertained by it. And really the turnaround was rather recent in terms of like the films of Ari Aster or Karen Kusama or Alex Garland, which had some horror elements to it. And, you know, as a sociologist, I found that like the social commentary of horror films to be stronger and more persistent than in any other genre. And so that, you know, because we always try to marry what we do our work with our passions. And so it's one of those things where it's like, oh, if I'm going to really be, you know, studying this from a sociological perspective, I can't exclude an entire genre. Right?
Yeah.
So I just decided to, bite the bullet in some senses and started to look for the really interesting parts to it. And then kind of like exposure therapy, I just sort of like got over it.
That's awesome. Well, and it's really important to remember that like not all horror is just slashers. Like not all horror is like blood and guts.
I think most people don't, that's the image that most people have when they think of horror. And I think me growing up in the time period that I did, when it was so prevalent of the horror media diet, was this sort of slasher, people running and like, you know, demons, dream demons trying to kill you. You know, I'm like, oh, there's more to it than that. That might not be my flavor, but there's these other, you know, flavors that I do kind of like.
Yeah, definitely. I'm still trying to explain that to my parents, and they refuse to acknowledge it. So Jurassic Park is not a horror movie, according to my dad. So,
well, okay, then I have a question. What's his criteria?
I think it has to be a slasher, maybe, or have lots of gore.
Okay.
I mean, but there's gore in Jurassic Park, so I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm interested to see where people's, you know, categories are drawn always, you know, of what is and what is not horror or a thriller, or, you know, because with us human beings, right, we can't allow something to be sort of blended together in some kind of way. We always need to categorize it into a specific thing.
Yeah. I should make my parents watch Get Out, because there's like no gore in that at all. So.
But it's terrifying.
Yeah. 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 So why do you think that people who seem perfectly sane love the horror genre?
Well, I think it really depends on why they love it. You know, for some people, you know, it may not be the same for loving certain films, right? Or certain other films and genres, right? So like, some people may not like torture porn, right, of the horror films, but they may like the supernatural horror and these sorts of things. So I think it really comes down to why they love it. But more generally, or more broadly, I think it comes down to the way in which horror films can really play with that ratcheting up of tension and then release. Right. I think that horror films have a beautiful way, especially when they're done, you know, properly, that they can ratchet up the tension and relief and have that relief, which ultimately connects to the way that we experience life and, you know, adrenaline and this sense of it being an addiction, right? Because if you can do it right, you can just get people on the hook of just tension, 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 release, right? And that's something that we're all really looking for in a number of different contexts, from our media and even from our relationships, right? For me, it's the way in which horror elements have like, or act as a proxy, a narrative proxy for society, right? And for social ills and social problems, the sort of overall commentary that horror films have on the state of the world is what I love.
Yeah, that's a great answer. So what scares you in real life and in horror movies today?
Well, in horror movies, let's start there. I am a sucker for the jump scare, believe it or not. Every single time. I know it's coming. I know that the music gets pulled out and it's completely dead silent. I know that thing is going to pop out from around the corner. Still gets me every time. And, you know, and I'll be the one, I'm not ashamed to admit it. I'll be the one sitting there going like this and being like, I'm not really looking, but I'm kind of looking like through my fingers and all that sort of stuff.
Well, speaking of jump scares, you were just on another podcast talking about the Ring movies. Speaking of the 2002 American remake, did you jump at the jump scare with the face?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Well, there's a couple things going on there too, because how many times in, I think, the Ring films in general, but especially in the first one, do they redo the shot from Psycho where they pull the body of, or they pull the chair around and you get the Mrs. Bates skeleton, right? They seem to do the same thing in the Ring films when she taps the chair and it rolls around.
Yeah.
And then you get the face.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm not really familiar with Psycho. I watched it once very long ago in college, and then I watched the remake actually at the beginning of the pandemic, but I don't really remember it that much.
We don't talk about the remake.
Yeah, that's what I've been told. So, yeah. And then what scares you in real life?
I am a sociologist that studies systems. And one of the reasons why I study systems is because bureaucracy scares me, right? Like the organizational systems that will continue after we die, really highlighting the fact that we don't matter is terrifying to me, right? The amount of paperwork and order and structure that you have to follow in a, you know, seemingly irrational order, because you need like form 27A and then form 36B, and no, you needed to get that signed by, you know, the person that went to lunch an hour ago, and now you got to wait, and you know, it ultimately creates what sociologist Max Weber calls the iron cage of our daily existence that ultimately bleeds us dry of any kind of human uniqueness or passion for life itself, even to the point where, like, when as film scholars and stuff like that, you think about your own horror films and like what you would actually create. And I've always had an idea in my head of a horror film based upon sociological concepts. And so it would be kind of like a Saw-based sort of trap-level horror film. But the only way that you could get out of it is if you know something about sociological theory.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, that definitely resonates with me since I work in HR at a huge institution. So there are lots of processes, and I'm still learning a lot of them. So. Yeah.
Double stamp. You didn't double stamp it. You gotta go back to Karen. She's got a stamp.
It's all digital. There's no stamping. So so what's your favorite subgenre in horror? I know it's not slashers.
No, it's not slashers. It's not the torture porn. It's not any of that. It's more so like postmodern horror, followed by gothic horror and supernatural horror. I do like some horror comedy, but I think that is a hard genre to really lock down, right? Because oftentimes it becomes too campy, as opposed to something that's horror, right? I think the Scream franchise got it the best in terms of the balance.
Yeah. What did you think of the classroom scenes in Scream 2, since you're a teacher?
Well, the way in which those students talk about film, they often talk about film much like grad students, less like undergrad, right?
Oh, interesting.
Because of the formal or the lack of formality in terms of like those particular film classes. And I do have to take a little bit of umbrage because they only talk about 70s and 80s, like Cameron and like these 70s directors like Coppola, because they mentioned The Godfather, because they're talking about like horror sequels that are better than the original. And I just have a distaste for evangelizing new Hollywood of the 70s like they were gods or something. And I'm like, well, they evangelized them and deified them so much that they got to be, you know, heads of their own studios, and then they fucked it up for the rest of us. So like I always, whenever I talk to people who are into film or film bros, as they're talking, if their favorite films are like, you know, Dog Day After, well, that might not be a best example. If it's like Goodfellas, or if it's like, the Terminator, like Cameron in the 80s, and then specifically like Coppola or Spielberg, anyone who says the best director is Spielberg, I'm like, he's a good director, but he's not God.
Well, that leads us into our next question. Do you have any favorite horror directors?
Well, I am about to start a, because on my blog, I do director, I do a focus of directors. So I've done like Christopher Nolan. Now I'm kind of soured on Nolan, but that's another story. I've done Hayao Miyazaki. So I did all of the Miyazaki films. I've done the Chambara films of Akira Kurosawa, because his filmography is so large, I couldn't do the whole thing. And right now I'm doing the films of Karen Kusama. Mm. So I'm finishing up with her filmography. In terms of horror, Jennifer's Body, everyone needs to see Jennifer's Body. It is a wonderful horror comedy amalgam that just hits all the right places, like hits all the right spots. They're amazing. I am then going to go into Anna Lily Amanpour and A Woman Who Walks Alone at Night, and The Bad Batch, and apparently she's doing well, and then Mona Lisa and the Red Moon. That was her last film, which was amazing. But now apparently she's going to do a remake of Cliffhanger with an all-female cast.
Oh, nice. I hadn't heard about that.
We'll see. Well, I mean, that's the rumor. We'll see. But other directors, as I mentioned, Ari Aster and Robert Eggers with The Lighthouse, I think, is a really interesting look into masculinity, especially isolation and masculinity, especially given the trajectory of that film.
Yeah, I only watched it once. Robert Eggers is not my director, but I know. I think that film is probably very divisive. What did you love so much about it?
I liked the way in which it was a throwback to a lot of older films. It was shot in 4:3. It was in black and white. It's basically a two-person film with virtually nothing else. And it everyone is an unreliable narrator and you have no idea what's going on. And you just have to let the film wash over you. And those films like that require rewatches over and over again. And I don't even get a lot of the references that are being referenced. I'm like old, like sea shanties and like there's like Prometheus sort of references to like Greek mythology and like Christian allegories and a number of other different stuff that I'm just like, yeah, okay.
Nice. So maybe I need to give it another watch to really get it.
It is a acquired taste, but I mean, many of my students have said that same thing about me, right? You either sort of love me or you hate me. You know, there's no real middle ground.
Oh, but I do love Ari Aster. I think Hereditary is like a perfect movie.
Yeah, I mean, I've looked at that scene where we can do spoilers, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I've looked at that scene where she cuts her own head off with the piano wire. And I'm like, that's shot in such a way that like, I'm pretty sure I know how they do it, but I'm not exactly sure how they shot that, but that is like fantastic. I mean, I go back and forth on which one I like better between that and Midsommar. Catch me on a different day and I'll say the other one.
Are you looking forward to Bo is Afraid?
Yes, that is actually on my list upcoming films that I want to really look at. Like, because again, it's one of those things where I'm like, I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, you can't tell from the trailer, which I've watched like 7 times already.
And for some reason, it might be the color palette or the way that Joaquin Phoenix is actually playing it. But I'm actually being reminded of that Richard Dreyfuss and Bill Murray film called What About Bob?
I don't know that one.
And it's just like one of those, it's about like a psychiatrist and his patient, and his patient becomes overly obsessed with him, but it's all like a comedy between Richard Dreyfuss and Bill Murray. But for something about that trailer and something about the color palette, I'm like, that he kind of like is invoking that a little bit.
I'll have to check the trailer out later and see. So you host the Sociologist Dojo podcast. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that and how it came about and how long you've been doing it?
Sure. Well, it came about because the blog, I'm celebrating the 10th anniversary of the blog here in June. So the blog started first because I hated Zack Snyder's Superman or Man of Steel with the Fire of a Thousand Suns. I think the film is atrocious. for a lot of like film geek reasons, and then like comic book geek reasons, and then just on a sheer like anti-toxic masculinity reasons, right?
Okay.
So that started the blog, and I was, you know, writing on that for a number of years. And then when I got on Twitter, I got connected with another sociology podcast called The Social Breakdown. And they had me on as a guest. And in that talk, we were talking about one of my essays. And in that talk, one of the hosts said in our discussion, pop culture is soft power. And that really struck me. I was like, it is. It does have an effect on decision making and, you know, the way in which we see and understand the world. So I would, and under their encouragement, especially Dr. Ellen Miser from the Social Breakdown podcast, they encouraged me to actually start the podcast. And so I really wanted a sociological analysis of film based in the sociological perspective, which tells us that we need to understand anything, you need to put it in its historical context, right? And so in my podcast, I have four basic sections. I have the section about my guest, and then the basics of the film that we're going to talk about. Then I have the historical context section where we talk about, you know, when the film was made and when the film is placed. So the film as a historical and cultural product in and of itself, and what that means. And then our own experiences with the film when we saw it, how we felt about it, these sorts of things. And then the social analysis section where we use our training, whoever I have on, they might be historians, they might be sociologists, they might be anthropologists, or they might be pop culture scholars. And we use our training to analyze the film's themes and the overall structure of the film and the messages sort of behind it. So we talk about things like representations of masculinity, or we talk about things like, is this a representation of capitalism, or, you know, all of these sorts of things. And then we have the sort of outro of like plugs and all that sort of stuff. And then usually I like to tag a fun thing at the end, like some sort of like outtake of like that, something that didn't really fit. And I like to just stick it on the end of each episode.
Oh, that's so fun. That's such a cool concept. And especially because you have like other sociologists and scholars on. Do you ever have a hard time finding a sociologist or a scholar or someone like that who wants to come on and talk about horror?
Sometimes. I mean, the issue is that like I run in a very academic heavy circle. So all I have to do is be like, who wants to be on the next episode? Right.
Yeah.
And I have my regular cast that comes in. Like,
okay.
I have like four or five people that always like, we have a good rapport and we always like to talk to each other about things, and it gives them sort of opportunities to plug their work and these sorts of things. So I always try to connect to people. If I haven't talked to them before, I want to make sure if they have like a book coming out.
Yeah.
Or if they have something to plug, I'd be like, hey, come on my podcast. You can, I will read your book. I will talk about it intelligently. And then we can move on to a fun film topic from there.
That's so cool. What horror movies have you covered in the past?
I've covered, let's see, the Scream franchise. We've covered the general subject of queer representations in horror. We mentioned, I have a Ring episode coming out. I just a couple of weeks ago did an episode on The Menu.
Oh,
that was there. Let's see what else. For the holidays this year, I did an episode of Gremlins.
Oh, where was the sociological analysis of the Gremlins? Because that seems so basic.
Oh, well, it's where I landed is that the Gremlin character and Gizmo are sort of representations of childhood, and they go through the cycle of early childhood to middle childhood. And it will actually, if you look at it in that context, you will actually see that maybe you don't want to have kids, right? in that regard, because they turn into gremlins and then they destroy everything.
Oh yeah, that's definitely my take on it. So yeah, that's really interesting. I'll have to go listen to that. Do you have any horror movies that you plan on covering in 2023?
Not specifically, because the way that I gather my guess is that I leave it open to them. I'm like, well, what do you want to talk about? Right. Mm-hmm. If you'd love to talk about horror, we can absolutely talk about horror. And luckily, Dr. Jamie Hartless is a, you know, unofficial horror scholar, and she likes to come in and talk about all the different types of horror films that are out there. As of this recording today, we spent nearly 2.5 hours talking about The Ring and all the different iterations, because she read the books, saw the original Japanese film, and then all of the three American remakes.
Nice. I haven't watched The Ring 2 in a really long time. I have a copy because I got it at a thrift store, but I have not watched it probably since it was in theaters, and I don't remember anything about it, but the first one's my favorite.
Yeah, so, correct in that.
Rings was terrible.
Yeah, we get into that a lot.
Oh, it was just so bad. But I can't wait to hear that episode. That's so cool. Well, that sounds amazing. And if anyone likes horror and likes looking at it through a sociological lens, you can find him wherever podcasts are found. But you teach, your sociology teacher, like you were saying before, mm-hmm. I'm going to assume that you weave horror movies into your classes sometimes. Do you?
Yeah, well, I try to weave in popular culture a lot in different sort of aspects. I'm working on a revamp of my introduction to sociology class to only be using cinema as a lens to understand sociological concepts.
Okay. Oh, cool.
So, it takes a little bit, but yeah, like you can look at, we were talking specifically about Get Out. I mean, that is marred in trying to understand structural racism, trying to understand the way the consequences of racial discrimination and how it compounds over generations, and the sort of allegory of using sort of black bodies for white male purposes, right? Is heavily tied to this to slavery and segregation and mass incarceration, which are the three big mechanisms that have ultimately led to Black people and other people of color being considered, having second class status in the United States. So Get Out specifically, and a lot of Jordan Peele films, especially Us and Get Out, really play on those particular realities.
What did you think of Nope?
Nope. I didn't like it as well as Get Out or Us. I think the film is trying to be kind of like Jaws in this particular way, or at least in the way in which there was a lot of, those kinds of influences. And there's something about it that doesn't quite hit the same mark that I think Get Out and Us do. And to be fair, some criticism of Us, I do not share this, but some criticism of Us said the same thing when compared to Get Out.
Interesting.
You just had me remind me of, if we're talking about social analysis and like Get Out and why it's so important, the end of Get Out, when you see the flashing lights of what you assume is a police car, that is so brilliantly shot because everyone in the theater makes the same assumption.
Yeah.
It's oh my goodness, it's again police violence, black man going to prison or getting killed right there. And it lets it linger.
Yeah.
Just enough for you to completely buy into what's about to happen, and then he changes it, and it's brilliant.
Yeah, it's so good. I remember seeing that in theaters and the whole audience just like freaking out. So
did your audience gasp when they saw the lights? Because there are a few audible gasps in my screening.
Oh yeah, my screening was packed. My then boyfriend and I really had no idea what we were going to see, because I don't think anyone really did, because the trailer was so didn't give much away, like they usually don't. We went to see it at a movie theater in Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
So we were some of the only white people there. So it was a very interesting experience. And very awesome. So nice. Lots of gasping.
Yeah, absolutely.
So an article came out in 2020 that said that horror movie fans were handling lockdown better than non-horror movie fans. Why do you think that was the case?
Well, as a sociologist, right, there are a lot of other factors that would probably factor into that other than horror movie fans, right? So as a sociologist, I'm like, there's a little third variable problem. with that, just a tiny bit, that there might be other issues and factors that aren't being considered when that question is being posed. So I haven't read the study, so I don't know or your reference, but I think there's a lot of overlap other than film tastes that have led to some people handling lockdown better than others, one of which I think is introverts. Introverts are known to have dealt with sort of lockdown at in a better particular way. But I think horror can be used as emotional exposure therapy, as I talked about before. So when we were all, like many of us, feeling anxious about the state of the world and about what's going to happen and these sorts of things, that many horror fans not only are familiar with that feeling, but are familiar with that feeling in a very safe place, so that you can not only get that feeling, but in a horror film, get that feeling resolved. And it's something that we can't do in our real lives, but we can do in our entertainment. So if you're going into a horror film and you're already anxious about the state of the world, there is that little bit of escapism, but it's also this feeling that you can get those feelings relieved, that there's a catharsis there that is much needed in the during the times when we can't control the world around us.
Yeah, that's a really interesting answer, one I'm gonna have to think about more later. Okay, this is a new question that I'm asking people. What is one horror movie that you think is an underseen gem and that you don't ever hear talked about?
Underseen gem. Well, I mean, I will always stump for Mandy. I don't know how many people have actually seen it. So just my go-to is sort of Mandy. But, you know, outside of that, because I've talked about that, you know, way too much. Well, maybe not too much, but a lot. Just because a lot of people have not seen it or need to see it, I would, and I'm preparing to talk about it, which is A Woman Walks Alone at Home at Night, right, by Anna Lily Amanpour. I think that that really female horror directors and female directors in general need to get their due in terms of recognition, and they often don't get second bites at the apple the same way that their male directors do. They often get lower budgets, and they don't often they don't get final cut or final script approval and these sorts of things. So if you like, search out that film, search out the work of Anna Lily Amanpour, and any other female horror director that needs to be you know, celebrated. This is why I think Shudder is a great service for that. So if you're interested in like avant-garde horror stuff that you don't see in the mainstream, Shudder, the streaming service Shudder, is where to go.
Yeah, definitely. Shudder, reach out if you want to sponsor this podcast.
Absolutely. I've been trying to get Criterion Channel to sponsor my podcast for the last like 2 years.
Oh, one day. Are there any horror movies that you won't watch or that you won't watch ever again?
Yes. There is a film that I got on Criterion Blu-ray that I had to get out of my house because I could not keep it in my house at all. I couldn't look at it. Every time I'd walk by my physical media library, it would scream at me and I'd be like, no, you're leaving. And that is Salo, 300 Days of Sodom.
I've heard it's really intense. I've never seen it.
I got through the whole thing. I won the Pepsi challenge on that one. I got through the whole thing. I know some scholars that didn't make it 10 minutes.
Oh, wow.
And it's rough. It's so full of just disgusting torture that it has to do with like every aspect of the human body.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's never again.
All right. I'm gonna go read the Wikipedia page since I'll never watch it. Have you ever had any noteworthy experiences seeing a horror movie in theaters?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, not to keep harping on it, but like I first saw Mandy at an evening show at my local independent theater. Mm-hmm. And the energy that was in that film and the energy that was in that audience was palpable. Just there's a point in the film where he's killing the demon bikers and he like screams that he ripped his shirt and he snaps this guy's neck and then takes a shard of glass and does a mound of cocaine off of it. And the entire audience was up on their feet screaming. We were all in there. And sociologist Emile Durkheim calls this collective effervescence, right? Emotional contagion, the way in which emotion and energy can be just dispersed through a particular crowd, and everybody was feeling the same thing in that particular moment. It was glorious. It was a glorious moment.
That's awesome. That reminds me of when I went to go see Hereditary in theaters, and there's that moment towards the end where Toni Collette starts to come into focus in the corner of the room.
Yeah.
It just like rippled throughout the theater. Everyone's like, oh my God, it's right there.
Did they have the same reaction when her husband lights on fire?
I don't remember. I don't think it was as palpable. Okay, so what has your favorite horror movie been so far that you've seen in 2023?
There's sort of a couple. Like I like the ambition of Knock at the Cabin, but I don't like the delivery. Like the book is supposedly so sort of stripped down and sort of immaculate, and the film is kind of heavy-handed, but I like the attempt, right? I like it when people swing for the fences even if they miss, right?
Yeah.
Try not to sort of play it safe. I also like the possibility of Megan, but then it gets kind of odd towards the end there, with robot fighting and stuff like that. Other than that, I haven't seen a lot of horror films this year. I'm still waiting on seeing Infinity Pool. Have you seen that one yet?
I have, yeah.
And can you steer me in that direction or not?
I think it's a really interesting concept. Yeah, it's really weird. It's a very interesting concept. I don't think anyone has written a story like that before. I don't remember ever being bored. So, yeah. I don't think I'll watch it again, but I think it's worth one watch. So.
One watch. Okay. Yeah. Well, it's got me down then for one watch.
Yeah. And on the flip side of that, what horror movie are you most looking forward to seeing in the rest of 2023? We've already talked about Beau Is Afraid.
And then Evil Dead Rise.
Yeah.
Is like I watched that and I was like, they are doing something that is unique to the Evil Dead franchise, almost like the remake, where a lot of people got pissed off because like Ash wasn't in it, or there wasn't like this campy fun sort of tone.
Yeah.
What I've seen of the trailer of Evil Dead Rise, I'm like, yeah, I will be terrified. You know, mommy's with the maggots now is like cringe inducing, but I'm ready for it.
Yeah. I feel like that's going to be on a t-shirt really soon if it's not already.
Yeah.
That's the perfect Mother's Day gift, everyone.
Perfect. Absolutely. Every mother deserves that shirt.
Yeah. I really like the 2013 version because it's more modern. And I thought the original version is just, it's too campy and that's not my style. So, but I really liked the 2013 one. Is it the same director or?
That I don't know. Cause I just found out today that the Evil Dead Rise is connected to that film.
Oh, okay. No, it was directed by Lee Cronin. Are there any horror movies that you love that people generally don't like?
Every time that I make a person watch Mandy, they're like, why have you done this to me? they're literally like, I don't like, is something wrong with you? Like, do you have like what is this? And I'm like, it is a masterpiece. And they're like, they come away with it like having, I think, a poorer opinion of me. I once made a recommendation to my mother for The Invitation, Karen Kusama's The Invitation, not the vampire one that was recently, but 2015's The Invitation. And I think I got a text from her like a week later, and she's like, why do you hate me? And I was like, what do you mean? And she's like, that movie, why would you recommend that to me? I'm like, it's really good. She goes, yeah. I know it's good, but it's awful. And I was put on the bench. I could not recommend a film to her for like 3 years. I was put in the doghouse for that one. I was like, I think that was unfair.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah, I love The Invitation. I think it's great. I wish they would release it like on DVD.
I'm looking for, I would love, well, everything that I love, I want a Criterion release for, right? I would love a Criterion release of all of the films that I absolutely love. I'm trying to, like, if they do like a Criterion edition of Mandy, I would want to write the booklet essay for it. Like that would be my payment. You don't need to pay me. Just let me write the insert essay.
One day. If you could remake one horror movie, which one would it be?
I think rather than like remake it or remake a film, which can be ish iffy, I would love to reinstate Karen Kusama's version of Dracula that got halted. It was called Harker. It was about Mina Harker. And like, I don't know exactly what it was going to be about, but I can't believe that got scrapped. Like, I'm really disappointed and would love to have it go forward.
Yeah, I would love to see her, anything that she would do. So,
yeah. And I mean, if we're talking about actual remakes, the last two Halloween films, I think, need to be, atomized. And there's like three or four different sequences in each of those films that I think could be easily inserted in the 2018 film, and you wouldn't know it.
So my last question is, if you had to spend quarantine with one horror villain, who would it be?
William Dafoe from The Lighthouse.
How come?
I think we'd get along swimmingly. I think we would sing sea shanties. I wouldn't complain about his lobster. I would let him like have weirdo tentacle sex with whatever's in the lighthouse. And, you know, I would do the daily chores. I think it's win-win.
Nice. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here. Do you want to tell everyone where they can find you and your blog and your podcast on the internet?
Absolutely. Well, you can follow the podcast, by searching The Sociologist Dojo. And I have, through wherever podcasts are found. You can, I also have a link to the blog and the podcast on my Twitter handle, which is @TheSociologists on Twitter. And that's where I, go through and submit or have links to essays and episodes. I write one essay a month, same thing with my episodes, one a month. Right now, I think for April, it will be coming up soon, within the next week, it'll be the last film of Karen Kusama, Destroyer. I'm gonna have that essay up pretty soon. And then the latest April episode of the podcast, as of this recording, will be House of the Dragon with Dr. Simone Kolish.
Very nice. Well, those will definitely be out by the time this comes out. So thank you so much again for your time, and I'll see you around on Twitter.
Absolutely. Don't be a stranger.
That's it for this week's episode of Who's There. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Brian Berleg, and thanks again to Brian for coming on. I'll leave links to his socials in the show notes, along with his blog and his podcast. You should go check it out. You can follow us on Twitter at Who's There Pod, or on Instagram at Who's There Podcast. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, horror movie recommendations, or you'd like to be a guest, shoot us an email at whostherepc@gmail.com. Until next time, stay scary and never ask, who's there?